The first 3 days that we were there, it was very hot. It was hotter than I said it was going to be. It was unseasonably hot. We got up to 103 on the second day. But by the end of the trip, the last half of the trip, it was 83 and sunny during the day and about 62 or 3 at night. It was perfect weather. And we had a 6-hour delay going over there when we got to Newark. So we waited in the airport 6 hours for our flight, then got on a flight that took 10 and a half hours. So I didn't see the sun for a long time. It's culturally a bit shocking at times. We ate lunch one day at a Palestinian restaurant the day we were in the West Bank. Best lunch we had the whole time we were there. And I was mistaken for one of the waiters at a Palestinian restaurant. I don't know how that happened, but I was. They don't stamp passports in Israel. They give you a little ticket. And the reason they do that, come to find out, is if you have an Israeli stamp on a passport, there's some countries in this world won't let you in. So they do you the favor of not stamping your passport, but they do give you a stamp when you come in and when you leave. There are a lot of checkpoints, a lot of things to go through at the airport just to get to leave the country and also to come into the country as you would expect, but everything went fine with that. I have to define a couple of terms. We've done this before. We did a Wednesday night series about terms like this. We studied about Islam a little bit. Remember, Arab is an ethnicity. Someone is Arab. It'd be like saying someone is white or black or Indian or something like that. There's no connection to a religion when you say somebody's an Arab. That doesn't really mean anything. There can be Arab Christians. There can be Arab Muslims. Most Arabs are Muslim. We know that. But that's just, doesn't have to be that way. Arab is an ethnicity. Our guide that we met there that was with us every day and talked on the bus, on the microphone, and told us all about the country, he's lived there most of his life, lived in America for a while. He's an Arab Christian. So he looks like everybody there, but believe he's connected with a Greek Orthodox Church or something along those lines. But he spoke our language, so to speak, in terms of Christianity in a land that is Israel's 80% Jewish, 20% is mainly Muslim, but there are a small percentage of Christians among that 20% that's not Jewish. There are, and among those Christians, self-identified Christians, of course, there's a Catholic influence. There are a lot of Catholic churches in Israel. That also run a lot of the sites. The Mount of Beatitudes, where they think the Beatitudes, or the Sermon on the Mount was given. That whole property is run by the Catholic Church. So there is that sort of representation there in the country as well. Israel has 8.2 million people. The northernmost point and the southernmost point is 261 miles. That's it. So if you had an American interstate that ran north to south through Israel, it's 3 hours. You could cover the whole thing. What's that? That's national Memphis, essentially. Maybe give or take. About half of that is east to west, from the Mediterranean to the Jordan. So it's not a big piece of land. It's pretty small, particularly compared to all the countries that border Israel. It is the only democracy, of course, in the area. And what's interesting also about Israel is that they do not have the death penalty. The last person executed in Israel was Adolf Eichmann, a Nazi war criminal in 1962. Jewish Secret Service found him. Wasn't in Israel, of course. He was hiding. They found him, put him on trial, and hanged him in Israel. And that's the last person ever put to death in that country. I want us to look today, start off by talking about Bob, Ahmad, and the Stolen Watch. Now this is a scandalous picture, and I'll tell you why in a minute. It's Bob and Karen Searcy. They go to Hillsboro Church of Christ. We're on a trip with us. And the good-looking guy on the right, of course, is me. This is taken at, depending on what you want to call this, it's either the Dome of the Rock or the Temple Mount. If you talk to a Muslim, That is Dome of the Rock in the background, the Golden Dome. If you talk to a Jewish person, that's the Temple Mount. And they're very serious about that. If you ask a Muslim person, hey, where's the Temple Mount? He's probably not going to answer you. Probably just going to look at you funny. And vice versa. All goes back to Genesis 22. That's Mount Moriah, where Abraham took Isaac to be offered to the Lord. The Muslims there will tell you that he meant to offer Ishmael. Your Bible, of course, says otherwise. The temple, we know, was destroyed in the year 70. Jesus said it was going to be destroyed, and it was. He predicted that in Scripture, and that's exactly what happened. Rome, of course, after doing that, built a temple to Jupiter on that spot, where that dome is, into the first century. By about 600, the Muslims had taken that whole area, had conquered that whole area where that picture is. And I'm skipping a lot of history here, but basically since about the 600s, remember Islam wasn't a world religion until about the 600s. Keep that in mind too. We have a religion that starts way after Jesus. But skipping a lot of history, this area has basically been controlled by the Muslims since the 600s. And if you remember, many of you remember the Six-Day War in 1967, when Israel pushed the nation of Jordan out of what was now the West Bank to the other side, east of the Jordan River. East of the Jordan River is the country of Jordan. And that time, when that happened, many of you remember Moshe Dayan, foreign minister of Israel, raised an Israeli flag over that dome. Now you can imagine what that stirred up. Well, he took it down, and he said, for this quote, for the sake of peace, we'll leave that site like it is, controlled by the Muslims. And they could have made it an issue. They could have taken that part back, put it back in Israeli control. But he said, you know, we're done fighting for today. It's not worth it. It's been controlled by the Muslims for so long. We'll just keep it that way. In 1993, King Hussein of Jordan, you've heard a lot about King Hussein, still there. He sold a house he had in England for about $8 million and refurbished the dome. And so the dome you see in that picture, the latest improvement that was made in the early 90s by King Hussein selling some of his real estate. Because he's a Muslim, several Muslim federations take care of the site, they run it. And so the latest refurb that happened was in the early 90s by him and his funding. Why is that site so significant to Muslims? Why is it not just a Jewish significance? Why doesn't it just have Jewish significance or Christian significance? Well, they believe that that's where Muhammad ascended to heaven with the angel Gabriel. And there's a rock in there. That's why I call it the Dome of the Rock. There's a large rock in there that we couldn't go see. That's inside the dome. And they believe that's where Muhammad ascended. For the longest time, for centuries, there were actually three holy cities of Islam. There's Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia and Jerusalem. And for centuries, when Muslims bowed to pray, you know, today they pray toward Mecca. They face Mecca when they do their prayers. For the longest time, they face Jerusalem. It's only sort of a modern situation where Jerusalem is no longer one of their holy cities. It's just Mecca and Medina down in Saudi Arabia. So this is a very important site to them nonetheless. That's why they care so much about it. Of course, Jews care a lot about it because that's where Solomon's temple was. David began the temple. Solomon finished the temple. That's where it was. It's on Mount Moriah. That's Mount Moriah. Today, the top, again, the top of those steps, really all that area where we're standing, is Muslim controlled. But the bottom half, around the outside of that, the temple area, is Jewish. It's run by the Israelis. One of those parts is the Western Wall. Many of you are familiar with the Wailing Wall. You've probably seen pictures of the Wailing Wall, where Jews, it's an open-air synagogue. There's no ceiling, but you have the Western Wall. It's down underneath where that picture is. One side there of the temple remains. It's a wall that they believe is part of the original Solomon Temple. And so there's an open area where the Wailing Wall is, and then you go to an arched room that doesn't have a door on it, and that's kind of the inside part of the synagogue. And we could go to either place. We went to the Wailing Wall. The women, men and women are separated. Women go on one side. You can't see them. They put a barrier between. But the wall is extended here. There's a barrier. The men are on one side. The women are on the other. And anybody can write a prayer on a piece of paper and stick it in the wall like the Jews do. They do not restrict in terms of who can do that. And they say, well, what is the deal with the Wailing Wall? Why do they do that? Why do they go up to that wall and put little prayers in there and pray and go through these types of things? Why do the Jews do that? Well, because they believe, due to all the excavations and all the archaeological digs and everything around that place, that wall, that Western Wall, is the closest point to the Holy of Holies that you read about in the Bible. So they're going to try to put a prayer as close to the Holy of Holies as they can get. And that happens to be on that wall. So they put those prayers in there. Every 6 months, they take all the prayers out and burn them. Because obviously, after a while, there wouldn't be more room to put a prayer. So twice a year, they empty them, they burn the prayers, and people keep using it that way. You have to have your head covered to go down there. If you had just a regular baseball hat or any kind of hat, that's fine. If you don't, they give you one. And they say sometimes when they run out of those, men walk around like this. But you have to have your head covered by something. So some places we had to go into, you had to keep your head covered. And other places went into, you had to take your hat off. Depending on where you were and who's in charge and all that kind of thing. There were rules for where we were in that picture. Again, that's run by Muslims. When we were on the bus on the way over there, our guide was on the microphone, Arab Christian, and he was telling us the rules. He told the women before we left, he said, cover everything. Cover up your neck, cover your arms. He said they kind of are arbitrary about it. He said, sometimes I take a group, we go through the security, and they'll tell some woman not to go in. And he said she'll have a sleeve down her elbow, and the next one will come in with a sleeve at her shoulder, and they'll let her in. He said sometimes it's just arbitrary. He said so, just to skip all that, cover up. And so a lot of ladies, you see, she was fine as Karen Searcy. She just had long sleeves, long pants, and that was fine. Some of the women that went just took scarves, they put in their purse, and they just took them out and kind of wrapped up with them, put them around their waist, that kind of thing, no problem. You cannot have a Bible where that picture is taken. Bibles had to stay in the bus. Everywhere we went, our guide would, on the trip, would talk about the archaeology and the history and all those types of things, and then Dan Chambers, who led the group here, that's spoken here before, from Concord Road, Church of Christ, in Brentwood. He would do a 5 or 10 minute lesson from the Bible about when we were in Nazareth. He would do a lesson about Nazareth, when we went to Bethlehem, all those kind of places. Well, some people, Dan had a little small Bible he could stick in his belt when we went places, and so he left the bus, had to do that. They don't let Bibles up there. Another rule is that our guide told us as we were on our way was, he said, you can't hold hands with women. Husband, wives, you can't kiss. You can't do anything like that. So, okay, we do that. So we get there, and somewhere, he may have said it, I don't know, but we didn't. I wasn't the only one that didn't hear it. They allow cameras. You can have cameras in there. So we're taking pictures. You see people behind us. All the people behind us were Asians. The whole week we were there, Asians everywhere, by the way. And so everybody's taking pictures. So Bob, this was the second to last day we were there, and Bob said, he was trying to get pictures of everybody. He said, James, we ain't got our picture made with you yet. And I said, okay. I said, use my phone first. So I just pulled my phone out and handed it to another guy in the group. He took that picture. So then Bob gave the guy his camera. About the time that happened, here comes a security guard. Comes over there and he says, don't touch. Don't touch the women. Of course, we're as much touching as probably you can have. And so he stood there. He didn't take his camera, but he made Drew, the guy who took the camera, delete the picture. Because that's a scandalous picture, you can tell. But I got mine. Because my phone was back in my pocket. By the time all that was going on, I just stood there. So I was in the clear. And I'm not going to put that online. I can't. I'm not going to risk that. Because Muslims know what the rules are up there. And that's a serious place for them. So I'll show you and all that, but I'm not going to put that anywhere publicly online. But all the they were handing out. There were some people going around with Islam tracts and things like that to hand to people that were there. The security guard wasn't armed. He was pretty stern about it, but he wasn't just abrasive about it. Again, he didn't take the camera and throw it on the ground or anything, but he watched him delete the picture. But what about this watch? It applies to the same couple. That morning, we were in the hotel eating breakfast, and Bob says, I lost my watch. I don't know where my watch is. And so we're sitting there eating and said, you know, you try to backtrack and where you've been. And he said, we looked all over the room at the hotel. We have looked everywhere. We're trying to figure out where I could have lost my watch. And so somebody said, well, look at your camera and look at pictures to see if you got it all in this picture and you don't have it in another one, that's going to help. So he got his camera out there at breakfast, and he's thumbing through there, and he says, oh, no, I don't know what happened. Here it is. The first night we were in Jerusalem, we went straight to the Mount of Olives before we went to the hotel. And we get to the Mount of Olives, which looks out over the city. I mean, you see the whole city. It's a beautiful shot. Well, we went there first, and they had two guys there giving camel rides. Basically, for whatever price you want to negotiate with them, you have to get on the camel, go around a spot that's probably wasn't as big as this building, and, you know, take pictures, whatever. So something these guys were doing to make some money. Well, that's the first place we went. Well, Bob and Karen got on the camel, did a camel ride. And there's a picture of him on the camel with a watch. And there's a picture of him standing beside the camel without a watch. Because when the guy helped him off the watch, off the camel, grabbed him by the wrist, flicked the clip, pulled it right off. Instead of pulling it, of course, over his hand, which you'd feel that. So when the guy reached up to help him off, he just pulled his watch right off. And there was just evidence right there on his phone. So we knew he did it. And the problem with this watch was that it was 40 years old. His wife, Karen, gave it to him after she bought it in Switzerland. It was not a cheap watch, and it had a lot of sentimental value. So, that was the morning after we got to Jerusalem. It happened the day before. We figured out that morning. Well, we're going right back to the Mount of Olives that day on the itinerary. So we told our Arab Christian guy what happened, and he was furious. He said, we're going to go back over there. I'm going to tell those guys that every time I bring a bus over here, I'm going to get up on the bus and say, nobody ride that camel. He said, you're going to lose so much money. He said, I will take all your business. He said, if I would see that watch. So we start talking about it. We get on the bus, and I'm thinking, this might not go the way we want it to go. Because there seems to be, you know, we're about to have a standoff over this watch. It's going to be 24 white Christian Americans versus this guy with this watch. And it's just a 5-minute drive back to the Mount of Olives. And we pull up. Every other time we went anywhere, our driver would obviously stop the bus, open the door, and we'd all get out. And he'd just sit there. He'd wait the bus, our driver. Well, we got up. This is us going back to the Mount of Olives. When he pulled the bus up, he pulled the door open, and he ran on the bus. Our driver's in the peach shirt on the right. A peach shirt, that's our driver, Ahmad. And he went nose to nose with that guy, and that's why I took a picture. I thought, we might need some evidence of this too. And he was after that watch. And so after the guy in the white hat claimed that his brother was a thief, didn't have any problem with that, and said he's probably got it. Bob, unbeknownst to his wife, had offered to buy the watch back. He said, tell the guy I'll pay for it. He said, we'll arrange something, you put it somewhere, whatever it takes, I'll buy it. He said, I'm not here, we're leaving in a few days. I just want the watch back. Well, they didn't get the watch back. I know that's hard to believe. But the guy in the pink shirt, the driver, keep in mind, our guy is the guy in the green shirt. That's the Arab Christian in the green shirt. And you kind of think, well, why is our driver so fired up about getting that watch back? Why does he care so much? Well, I don't know if he'd have done that otherwise, but I know this. That earlier in the week, a few days before this happened, he was talking to the guy, and they know each other. They do tour groups all the time. A guide, and he's got a driver. They don't always match up, but a lot of times they do, so they know each other. A few days before, our driver, who parked that bus and ran off the bus to get that guy's watch back, told our guide, he went up to him in private and said, I'm really surprised how well I've been treated this week. And they said, why is that? He said, well, white Christians from America, I just didn't know how they treat me. And you say, then again, why would you think that? Well, because the guy in the peach shirt is a Muslim. The guy in the peach shirt is not a Christian. And he thought, what are these Christians going to think of me if I drive them around for a week? And he had told the guy a couple of days before how impressed he was with how we had thanked him, we had treated him well, we included him in things. He kept a cooler of water just to the left and the right of that little bowl there. Cooler water every day, dollar bottle, which we had paid $10 a bottle every day. But he said, you know, I'm really impressed. He said, I'm just kind of surprised how well they would treat me. 2 days later, guess who's running off the bus? Get the watch back. The Muslim. So we kind of think about how far the golden rule goes. It kind of makes you think about how you treat people and how quickly somebody can change an opinion about somebody else. How we have stereotypes, how we have, well, surely this person I'd like to see. When we showed up, our guide said, I'm an Arab Christian. We didn't know he was Muslim. At no point did our guide say, "Oh, by the way, the guy driving the bus is a Muslim." It was really irrelevant anyway, but so we didn't know any of that. We didn't treat him extra special because he was a Muslim or Christian or anything else. The guy was driving us around for a week. But how quickly perceptions changed and attitudes changed just how you treat somebody that you've never met in your life. And so, who wants to get the watch back more than anybody else? It was our Muslim driver. This is Peter Atwood. Peter Atwood is British. He studied at Oxford, and he and his wife go to Jerusalem for 2 months a year to give tours at the Garden Tomb. There's New Jerusalem and there's Old Jerusalem. Just like in a lot of American cities. Particularly, if I went to Boston once, there's New Boston, and then you go in the old part of town, there's Old Boston. Jerusalem's the same way. In New Jerusalem, there's what they call the Garden Tomb. And that's where they have Gordon's Calvary. Remember the words, a little lesson here too, about the words cavalry and calvary. When the L comes first, Calvary is where Jesus died on the cross. Cavalry is men on horses. Okay? Well, British archaeologists found a hill in Jerusalem shaped like the one described in the Bible that even has a face on it. And I saw it with my own eyes, probably 50 yards away, and it really does have a face on it. We know that that hill is called the place of the skull. It's a bald kind of shape, and it looks like a skull. So they call it Gordon's Calvary because he discovered it. And that is off to the side of the Garden Tomb. And there's a tomb there that matches a type of tomb that Joseph of Arimathea would have owned. We know that he was the one that got the body of Jesus from Pilate and offered to bury Jesus in his new tomb. Now, that's kind of a modern place of Jesus' burial. Since the 400s, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Old Jerusalem has been the recognized place of both the crucifixion and the burial. Now, you go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, it's crowded. I mean, there are people that come from all over the world. It's been recognized as the place where all that happened. The Garden Tomb, people kind of think, maybe. That might have been it. The good thing about the Garden Tomb is it's peaceful. There's a garden. There is a tomb. But it kind of sets the mood a little bit better than the Church of the Holy Sepulchre that's just crowded and people running over people. Well, Peter Atwood, every year, comes there for 2 months to give tours. And as you can probably tell, Peter Atwood is 98% blind. He has a walking stick. He has sunglasses that cover doesn't allow any light in. Due to his disability. This is the first spot where we stopped on this tour. We went to the Garden Tomb. We all sat of this little area. I was sitting right in front of him when I took this picture. And the reason I took the picture was based on what he just said. As soon as we sat down, again, on the first part of this tour, this blind man said, "I want you to use this place as a visual aid." And that just knocked me off. This guy comes from Britain. 2 months a year to give tours at a place he can barely see and tells the rest of us to use this place as a visual aid. Pretty profound moment. And it made me think about 2 Corinthians 5:7, "For we walk by faith and not by sight." Peter Atwood is a Christian again in his self-identified. I assume the Church of England, I believe, that's what I was told. Obviously, what he does is by faith. He has 2% vision. He can't see nearly anything there, but he goes to give tours and tells us to look at it. Tells us to think about the things that took place in that area. And so the question is, how many things do you do by faith every day? Or do you do things based solely on advantages, solely on what's easy, solely on what you can determine is the best thing? Or do you ever do anything by faith where it says, Lord, I'm going to do this, and it may not work out, it may be, you know, I may do something else later, but I'm doing it by faith. You evangelize by faith, saying, you know what, I don't know everything there is to know in the Bible, but I'm going to speak to this person about Jesus because I'm going to do it by faith. Because the Lord wants me to do that. And I think if I do what the Lord wants me to do, I'm going to be blessed. So Peter Atwood taught me a lot about walk by faith and not by sight. When he gave that tour. Very quickly, we won't read the passage, but you know the story of Jacob's well. Jesus met the woman at the well in John chapter 4. This is it. Since the 300s, since the 3rd century, this has been considered to be Jacob's well, where that story took place. It is in the West Bank, which the Jews call Samaria even today, and in the Bible you read it was in Samaria. The West Bank is more of a Muslim designation for that area. We'll talk later about the West Bank later on in this series. It's a place I'd be all right if I never went back. It's a different kind of place. But if you pour water into that well, that bucket on the left is full of water, and people that come and tour, if you pour a little bit of water into it and count to three, you'll hear it splash. That's how deep it is. It is surrounded by a Greek Orthodox church. Greek Orthodox run it. There's doors on the outside by the street that you walk into. There's this beautiful garden area, marble floors, immaculate. The church itself is immaculate. It's a stunning place, and this is the priest at Jacob's Well. I don't have his name, and if I did, I couldn't pronounce it. He's been the priest there at that church for 36 years. Before that, he was a monk. He has given his life to preserving that well. He sees the visitors that come. It's a pretty small room. If you'll notice the three little jars, little white jars on the edge of his desk. They put water from Jacob's well in those jars. He seals them with wax from a candle that's there. You can't see it very well. He lights some candles. He puts wax on the top of the little jars to seal them. And he sells them for the upkeep of the church. The week before we went there, it was less, probably 6-7 days before we were there. About 12 or 14 Muslims broke in to the door by the street. They went in, broke a lot of things. And I know that you can tell that's an old man. And I don't think he weighs 100 pounds. They pulled a belt around his neck. Hit him over the head. He obviously survived. They caught the people that did it. But basically just kind of roughed him up, broke some things, stole a couple of things that they said wasn't real significant. But then he went back to work. And in the neighborhood that where that is not great. Again, it's in the middle of the West Bank. A lot of hostility around it. The two doors that open by the road to get in, the left one's got about 6 bullet holes in it. I don't know when those were put in, but they're there and they're obvious. But that is obviously a very significant place just in Bible literature. What went on there at Jacob's Well in Shechem, the town today is called Shechem, where that happened. All of that kind of reminded me, the lesson that came from that was like 2 Timothy 3:12. Indeed, all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. where Christians only mentioned three times in the Bible. One of the places where Christian is mentioned is 1 Peter 4:16. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. So here's a man that identifies as a Christian, not a group that does, of course. But in that part of the world, you line up with, you associate with other people that are Christians. Everybody is labeled, everybody, your life has a, is defined by those things. What you do, where you go, where you live, is about, are you a Muslim, are you a Jew, are you a Christian, are you some sort of offspring of any of those major groups? Here's a guy that says, I'm a Christian. Everything in that, of course, that Greek Orthodox, but by the way, the Greek Orthodox are a cappella in their worship. Everything in there, of course, is about Jesus, all the pictures, all the glass, all those types of things. So that is a that's a target for some people. And it makes us think about our own lives and how we identify as Christians. Would we be so outspoken about our faith if that's the kind of place we had to live in? Where he knows that if he walks outside that church building and across the little courtyard and walks out in the street, he gets looked at a certain way. What if that were here? What if that were you? That you went down where you worked, inside of your office, maybe you were safe, but you knew that when you went home and walked out on the street, and people knew you were a Christian, that that meant something, and it wasn't good. We don't face that today. We don't really think of those things. We just go about our lives and do what we do. But that's reality in that part of the world. What's the thing, finally, just what did these people teach us, these four people? Tell us a lot of things. We've already looked at most of those lessons. But first of all, prejudice is learned. And I know that by something that happened to me while I was there. We're in Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi in the Bible is the northernmost part Jesus went in his ministry. Today, Caesarea Philippi is about 20 miles from Syria. We could walk over, if we just kept walking, we could have walked, we went there. We could have walked over some hills and been in Syria. And when we left there, down the road, we could have stopped the bus and literally walked across, be like from here to the livery stables and been in Lebanon. That's how far north Caesarea Philippi is. Today, it's right in the intersection of Israel, Syria, and Lebanon. That's as far north as Jesus went and recorded Scripture. That's where Peter confessed Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. That's where Jesus said, upon this rock I'll build my church. That was in Caesarea Philippi. We were there one day, and as we were leaving, going back to the bus, there was a little creek. And on the other side walking in was a Muslim family. And I know that just by how they were dressed. Everything about them, obviously Muslim. There's a little girl, she's probably 2 or 3 years old, walking in front of them. So I'm walking this way, and they're walking a little creek between us the other way into the park. All these, most of these places we go are Israeli national parks. There's a ticket booth, it's maintained by the Israelis and so forth. So they're walking in, and so I make eye contact with the little girl. You know, just saw her walking in. And she looked at me, and so we kind of kept looking at each other. And so I waved at her, and she just stopped. She stopped and looked, and then she went. She just did her little fingers like this. And so I kept walking, I kept looking at her, we kept waving. And then right before I turned, like just turned my head to keep walking, she went. And so I blew a kiss back, and her mom was laughing. I mean, her mom was standing right beside her, she was laughing, and she kept walking. She doesn't know me. That little girl doesn't know anything about me. The only thing I know is I can assume with pretty good certainty that she's a Muslim girl. But the fact is, the rest of her life, what she thinks about people like me is going to be determined by what the older people tell her. Because in that, those 30 seconds that we saw each other, she wasn't afraid of me, she thought nothing of me, she didn't care who I worshiped, where I worshiped. I was just a person that smiled at her, waved at her. And we'll see, I mean, we won't know, but we'll, in her life, what she's told is going to be what she believes. And that's the same thing with all parents today with their children. What you tell your children, the attitude you have about things, what you tell them, where they can go, where they can't go, that's going to be right in their eyes. Because your mom and your dad. They're going to know, secondly, that we're Christians by our love. Jesus said that. That goes back to Ahmad, the bus driver. We didn't give him a gift. We didn't do anything special to him other than just respect him as a human being and treat him like the Lord told us to treat everybody. And just in that little act, a few little acts of kindness, all of a sudden he's ready to defend us. I know for certain that the guys that he went and talked to get that watch were also Muslims. No doubt about it. And he went to defend us because of simply the fact that we were nice to him. And lastly, with Peter Atwood, we walk by faith and not by sight. And it's something we have to do every day. We don't see heaven. We don't see hell. We don't see tomorrow. We don't see any of that. Neither did Abraham. Neither did Moses. Neither did Noah. But they said, God told us this. We're going to trust God, so this is what we're going to do by faith. So this morning we ask if you need to walk out in faith and believe the Lord about obeying the gospel, if you're willing to do that. That's the faith act. It's the first real faithful thing you may ever say, I believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God. I'm going to give my life to Him. I'm going to believe what He said about heaven. I'm going to believe what He said about hell. I'm going to believe what He said about judgment. I'm going to believe that He may come at any time. I'm going to be ready because I obey the gospel. If that's what you need to do this morning, you need to come back to the Lord as an erring Christian so we can pray with you, encourage you in that, and also do that for you. Whatever it is, please come while we stand and sing.